Hello and welcome back to the Plasticology Project podcast. As always, it is great to have you along. If you haven't been here before, this is a podcast where we talk about solutions to the plastic pollution problem. And again, if you haven't been here before, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to the previous episodes because we speak to incredible people around the world working to solve some enormous plastic pollution problems. This episode of the Plasticology Project podcast is a particularly special one because it coincides with World Environment and World Ocean Day 2023. The theme of World Environment Day this year is Beat Plastic Pollution. Now, what an incredible topic and theme that is. And to celebrate, we will hear in this episode from Ricky Herzberg, the Executive Director of Plastic Oceans Australasia. I'll hand it over now to Ricky, who will explain what Plastic Oceans Australasia is all about and what Plastic Oceans Australasia are doing to celebrate World Environment and World Ocean Day 2023. Before we get started on this episode of the Plasticology Project podcast, I just wanted to remind you that if you have a business that focuses on plastic pollution solutions, then I want to hear from you and share your message with the Plasticology Project podcast audience. You can sponsor an episode, have your product mentioned, or even have a link to your website in the show notes. These are all available through our sponsorship program, and a prospectus is available from the website or emailing me directly. So if you're interested in getting your product out into the world, now is the time to get in touch. Thank you, Ricky, for joining me on this episode of the Plasticology Project podcast. It is absolutely great to have you here and learn a little bit about what Plastic Oceans Australasia is all about and what it is that you do. So, Ricky, could you just give the audience an introduction to Plastic Oceans Australasia and give people some insight about your role and the mission of Plastic Oceans Australasia?
Thank you so much, Paul, for having me on your podcast series. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, so thank you so much. Plastic Oceans, fondly called by people that know us and internally with our teams, we've abbreviated it like a lot of people do in Australia with everything, and we call it POA. POA has been around for 6 years now, and we were born out of the Plastic Oceans UK Foundation, which is famous for the film A Plastic Ocean that was produced by Joanne Ruxton, who is the founder of the Plastic Oceans Foundation movement, as well as the producer of the very famous film, as I mentioned, which is quite well known. It's been watched hundreds and thousands of people around the world, still being used and watched now, even though it's 5 years old. So David Attenborough's in that film, and Sylvia Earle and other very notable marine and natural NRM, you know, what's Sir David? He's the most famous naturalist in the world, I believe, from what I know. So that movie was really the benchmark of how we started here. So we were born out of POUK, and they've now pivoted over and changed their name to Ocean Generation. So if any of the listeners wanted to see more about that, Ocean Generation UK is a website address, they can go to that. But we are still Plastic Oceans Australasia. So when we started over 5 years ago, our mission was to change people's attitude towards plastic pollution, and to do that through behaviour change programs that we deliver, as well as actual mechanical and methodology projects that people could get involved with to demonstrate what they were doing. So it was both hand on your heart and also the analytics of what's happening in your head. So the two things together, where the whole process was to squeeze out plastic.
Now, Ricky, I should probably disclose here that I am actually a volunteer with POA, and so I've taken on that POA the acronym now. And I volunteer with the technical advisory panel. So I help guide some of the research that happens within POA, and that sort of helps with the behavior change work that you do, and also some of the policy guidance work that you do. But that that takes me to the point that POA is more than just one person, isn't it? It's quite a large, dynamic organization.
Yeah, and yourself included. So thank you, Paul, for being with us. And it's a great pleasure to have you with your doctor hat on with us with the science team, which is very, very important work that we do. We're made up of a number of people from volunteers, student interns, work placement students and people that come to us, as well as staff. And we are spread across Australia, and we've also got a chapter in New Zealand, and we have started doing work in the last 2-3 years in Indonesia and spreading out our tentacles in across this space as such. So yeah, we have a diverse collective group of people from all walks of life, but also in different ways that they're working with us.
Ricky, I know a little bit of your backstory, and we were speaking before we got started on this particular recording about where you were born. And for I won't spoil a surprise, but you can share with listeners shortly where it was that you were born. But it actually relates to one of our previous podcast guests, Lumbani, from episode 1 of this season. What was your interest in plastic or plastic pollution problems before joining POA? What got you involved with POA in the first place?
Yeah, it's great question. And I get asked that quite a lot, Paul. And it actually all stems back to my dad. So my dad, sadly, who's just recently passed at the ripe old age of 96, was way ahead of his time in the world of plastic. And he was a textile engineer by trade or profession. And he was one of the first people to be weaving cloth, blankets, and all sorts of the normal cloth material you'd expect someone to do with the old-fashioned weaving with the looms. And he was very innovative, and he worked with a couple of companies that actually moved him around all over the world to set up weaving factories. And it was actually through my dad's work where I was born, which was Malawi, which is hence your first podcast, which is really interesting to hear about what's happening there. And so I was born there because of dad's work, and we moved around back and forth between Africa and the UK. And then eventually dad got commissioned to set up a big factory here in Victoria, which is where I'm based. And he actually was weaving polypropylene flour bags, and used that was the first start of the bagging, which was made not with the jute bag as such or the canvas bags, but actually they switched over to polypropylene. So dad then saw that there was a huge amount of waste that was coming through from the weaving, and all this wastage of the yarn and the cutoffs and the, you know, they were doing the injection molding, and he could see that the extrusion of the yarn as it was, the process was made. And he started thinking that there's something really wrong here and I should be doing something about it. So even while he was still working in his day job, he was thinking about what could he do to start to recycle this waste plastic. So that was way back already in the 70s that he started that. So he eventually went out and opened up one of the first plastic recycling plants here in Victoria. And I was just a young kid at the time. So my first job to get pocket money was working in the yard, sorting plastic, learning all about plastic waste streams, and seeing the overwhelming volume, because people just were throwing it away. It had no value. Nobody cared about it. And they just wanted him to come and pick it up, like the garbage trucks pick up our rubbish on the curbside. So picked up the waste, bring it back, and made it into something else. And he would recycle it to make it into something, whether it be injection molding or blow film or extruding it into another product, or just having it back into the spaghetti, which went back to the companies that he got it from. And that was how my journey started. So I was, you know, quite young, and I could see that there was a problem. I then did some study in chemical plastic engineering in Melbourne, and I've learned quite a bit along the way. I haven't done a full-blown engineering degree or anything like that in plastics, but over the years I haven't really needed to. I know enough that I, or for what I was doing. And that's been the journey going through. And then I started working with, you know, other environmental NGOs and in the corporate world. And then I've sort of done this big circle, and it turned out that through all the work that I've done with the plastic recycling and that back end, and seeing the issues and the problems, and trying to work out what solutions could be through that, I was asked to set up Plastic Oceans Australasia, and hence fast track forward about 3 decades. I'm now at the helm of what I'm doing through POA to try and move things and hasten things along, because it's such a major issue that we have in our environment.
Your dad was certainly a trailblazer, Ricky, and I think we have a lot to be thankful for in the way he was thinking back then about plastic and the problems that he was seeing in the production phase. So I think we can all give him a big thanks. And his work has led to obviously your incredible work through POA as well, and into the future. You spoke a moment ago about the challenges that POA is focused on and the solutions that POA is trying to solve. Can you expand some more on those solutions and also those problems first, and then the solutions?
Absolutely. I'll keep it as short as I can, because the problem is obviously quite big. I think we've got to a point in the world where, particularly in the developed countries, where people are starting to actually turn off when they hear the word plastic waste, plastic pollution, recycling, because it's talked about all the time now. Thankfully, it's taken, as I said, three decades for it finally to get to the top of the agenda, and people have sat up and said, oh, this is a real, this product is not going away anytime soon. It can't be, once it's been manufactured, it actually never goes away. And it doesn't matter how many times our wonderful manufacturers of the terrific products that are made, and we know that there is a need for particular products, particularly in the science and the medical space, absolutely. And just to put it out there, we're not haters of plastic at all. We talk a lot about the fact that plastic needs to be used and produced and disposed of responsibly if it has to be used. And there are essential areas where it will always be produced. So we know that plastic's not going to not go away. We know that there will always be new virgin materials that will be used, because they need that in medical science, etc. But it's the products that we don't need, those high volume single use products. Like my big pet peeve is the soy sauce fish little bottles, for example, or the little sachets that people get their salad dressings in when they go and buy salad that's already been pre-made. All of that is wrapped in useless plastic that will not get recycled and just gets thrown away, and it goes to landfill. So the millions of tons of single-use high-volume plastic items that we can actually pivot and use something else, or change our habits to do it a bit differently, so we don't actually need to use those little single sachets of salad cream or whatever it's going to be, or you know, salad dressing, is what we hit hard on through the purpose and the work that we do at Plastic Oceans. And the challenge that we have is, as I said in the beginning, people are turning off and are just getting glazed over. We've got economic challenges. We've got, you know, we've come out of COVID. We actually were super busy during COVID. We were very, very busy doing a lot of remote delivery and online delivery, doing the whole hybrid side of things. And I think people had a little bit more time, and they could see that plastic was really rearing its ugly head through the PPE, the masks, the gloves, the gowns, et cetera. And now, as we've come out of COVID, we're finding that people have become very blasé and just have gone back to what they did before COVID. And we've actually gone backwards in the steps that we were getting forward in, which was to change people's behaviour, stop using it, change to something else, and or just not use it at all. So instead of using a water bottle that's made out of PET, never have a PET water bottle, you know, have your refillable steel bottle or whatever it's going to be and use a water filler. And, you know, there was all sorts of things like that that were going really, really well. And the keep cup and, you know, the story goes on, and the cloth bags and you know, now straws are banned, which is great, you know, those sorts of things. So there has been some small steps forward, but we've actually gone three steps forward and, in my opinion, 10 steps back. So what do we do about that? Solutions. So we are now working really hard to turn the tide again, to get people to realise that the enormous increase, and it's estimated that there's over 30% more single-use plastic pollution that's been generated over the last 2 to 3 years through the COVID pandemic situation, that we are actually, as you know, you being on our TAP team, the technical advisory panel, one of our projects is actually doing that, is we're doing that piece of research to actually find out how, where has that waste gone during the PPE waste, where's that gone over the COVID period, the high intense part of COVID, how much was actually used, how much has been stockpiled, and how much is being disposed of that we don't even know about. So as you know, we're trying to do some work on that to get some hard numbers. So the challenge for us right now is to still get people to understand that it's part of the greenhouse gas emission cohort, it's part of climate change, it's not a silo, and plastic segues in and contributes quite dramatically, because it's crude oil, it comes from the ground, it's petroleum, it's a byproduct, and a lot of people still don't get that connection that the plastic is just another form of greenhouse gas emissions, and it's very, very difficult to get people to often think about that and get that connection.
That's a great point, and one worth just emphasizing, that plastic is a part of the greenhouse gas and climate change equation. We spoke last season to Professor Gabriel Filippelli from the US on exactly the topic of climate change and how plastic pollution is involved with that. But even for me, I sometimes forget how critical plastic is in that climate change equation. And so it's always good to be reminded from time to time, don't forget, this is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. There was some work recently that really drove home that point, and I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it was enormous percentages of the greenhouse gas emissions are derived from plastic, either the production or the recycling of plastic and the industry that surrounds it. And it's staggering to think about. And most people don't draw that connection.
No, absolutely not. And I think it's about 11% globally, but I'll have to check on that as well for you. But because the figure changes quite a lot. And also sometimes it's not accurate, the numbers that we're getting, and which type, whether it's single-use plastic or whether it's hard plastic or the total. So, yeah, but it's quite extraordinary that there's still a lack of understanding with the general public about the fact that plastic is very much part of the supply chain of the contribution to the global warming, which we're talking about all the time. And obviously we're doing a really, really bad job of it, because we're already going to be at 1.5 degrees way, way sooner than what they predicted at UNESCO and you know, the UN, it's actually quite frightening. And for myself, with you know, I've got children, family, and yourselves, and anybody that's going to have kids and do anything, you know, for future generations, it's a real worry. And one of the things that we do, as you know, is we work really closely with youth and the younger generation through our work that we do with the programs at schools. And because school children haven't lived so long with plastic, it's actually easier to help them change their habits because they haven't had it for decades and decades and decades and got so reliant on it. So they are the ones that can turn the tide and change things much faster than any of us like myself that are more mature age. So that's why we do focus quite a lot with the schools. But as you know, one of our other programs was born out of the schools program because we kept on being asked, could you deliver the same as what you're doing in the schools for big people? And that's how that, you know, the Engaging in Plastic-Free Innovation for Change, again, fondly known as the EPIC program, was born. And so I, you know, that is one of our success stories and one of the ways that we are providing a solution and not just saying, oh, yes, there's a big problem. Now what? This is, yes, there's a big problem, but let's do something about it and let's make some really demonstrable change.
Share with me how the EPIC program works. Run me through what that program looks like for the business side of things. And then we can come back to schools a little bit later as well.
Sure, absolutely. Well, EPIC is a 12-month program. It takes 9 months officially to change your behavior on plastic and plastic use. Can you believe the birth of a baby, the time it takes to have a baby, as in to develop and have your baby born? The 9 month period is how long it actually takes. And a lot of people are quite blown away with that fact. And that's through the behavior change experts that we work with and a lot of study and science behind the brain and what happens. So, you know, a lot of us, you know, we have a lot of people do the New Year's resolution. Oh, I'm going to, you know, stop smoking, stop drinking, start exercising, do this, do that. And they always say it takes 21 days to change a habit. Well, sadly, plastic doesn't fit into any of those. So our program that we designed and created was born out of, as I said, the schools program through people saying to us, we really want to do this. So we run it over 12 months. It's split into four parts and there's four stages. And each stage takes people through a systematic process of how they can actually learn, see what they're doing with their heart and what they're doing with their head. And we work through, you know, doing a baseline analysis on what is happening in the organisation. So for a business, and we work with the health industry, construction, some agricultural industries, government, commercials. So our program can be adapted to any industry type according to what the client is looking for. Plus, we can also do an abridged version, which is something I'll mention in a moment. So ideally 12 months, each stage is 3 months. We do a baseline modeling to work out what the organization is currently doing. And we look at internally. So it's all about what's happening with the staff, what they're doing at their work. And it does include contractors, subbies, suppliers, and also family. Like if they're having family days or, you know, community days, you know, wherever the extension of the spider's web, you know, it goes out to the whole of the community of that organization. And also goes back to people when they close the door at work and they go home, we also are working with what they're doing at their home habits. So it's not just, okay, when I go to work, I have to look like I'm doing the right thing. When I go home, I'm just going to go back and do the same old, same old. This is about really doing that systemic change with people. And that's why it takes so long. It's not just come in and do a presentation and say, oh, I must do that differently. And then people forget. As you know, the 80-20 rule, you know, you might remember 20% of a presentation. And if of that 20%, there might be one or two things they might remember. And maybe one of those two things they might do. So that's how tough it is, you know, as a speaker and an author and a, you know, all the things that you do in your daily life as well, Paul. So with Epic, what we've done is baseline modeling. The second stage is actually starting to look at what are the challenges, what did we find within the organization? And then we start to nut out with them, what can we do to help them find a solution? So we look at the solutions, we offer product, research data that we've done on products that we think might be suitable for people to switch over to, because that's the hardest part. It's very easy to see what the challenge is, but then how do you make it easy for a company who everyone's really busy, they've all got their own KPIs, everyone's busy, they're out on projects, the last thing they want to be given to do is another job. So we try and make it easy for people by giving them all the tools, the resources. So Epic has a toolkit which we provide with all the resources, plus we also provide the trainers. So we have a trainer that will go in, and we do on every stage, we do a workshop. So we have the four workshops. So stage one, baseline. Stage two, looking at the challenges, start to look at solutions, offer a plastic swap app, go through that. And then we start to look at how do we help the organization with that? We look at policy. We look at, do they have any policy? Do they have a procurement policy? Do they have a single-use plastic-free policy, sustainability policy, or even a waste management plan? Some organizations think they've got one and they did it, you know, 10 years ago, but it needs to be updated. Things are changing. So we look at all that policy admin side of it as well and try and help the organizations. Wherever there's holes in whatever they're doing, we try and fill gaps for them to make it easy. The most important thing is it's a terribly hard thing to knock on its head. So you've got to make it easy. And it can be, and also fun. One of the things we like to do, make it fun. And every small little win makes a big difference. So we find that that helps as well. And then we go to stage three and we start to deliver on the solutions. And at the end of stage three, which is between the 9 to going into the 12 months, which is stage 3 to 4, we then do the same thing. We repeat the survey and the audits that we do, and we see what's happened with the modelling from the baseline. How have we managed to change people's behaviour and actions from what we've done from the beginning to the end? So we actually can show what's been going on. And so far, it's always been a win-win. There's always been something really good that's come out of that. And even though it sounds like a long time, you know how quickly, I mean, look at us now. It's May. We're already nearly halfway through the year again. I'm like, oh no, I'm just getting used to 2023 saying that. So we go through that process, that cycle. And then at the so-called end of our program, I always say to people at the end of the program, we're setting you free now to go do your thing. And we want you to be the trainers, train the trainer and your new staff that are coming in and continue the cycle. So some organisations will take longer. Through COVID, we were working with councils, for example, and it took us 2 years to do the one-year program because people weren't at work. You know, there was all sorts of things that were happening. So the program is very, very structured, very organised, very systematic, and works. And one of the things we're super excited about, which I think I've mentioned to you in passing, is about the development of a carbon calculator. So that's going back to also what we talked about earlier about carbon emissions and greenhouse gas reductions. So that carbon calculator is going to be able to show people at the end of the program what they've been able to not put into the environment because they've mitigated the use of their plastic. So they can actually see they're being proactive by not using it in the first place, which is pretty cool, I think. Over to you.
Yeah, that's great, Ricky. That's a really awesome overview of what the Epic program is for businesses. And to pick up on something that you mentioned there, the program is not to it's not to stop at the door or as you leave your desk of an afternoon. You know, take it home with you and talk to the family about it. Share it with your friends and your community. And back to the schools where we know kids are quite often the most keen to learn and active in changing when presented with some of these issues, having the Epic program operating in schools and in the businesses, there's an overlap there because you're covering the entire spectrum of age, of age of influence, we shall say.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've been delivering successfully to primary schools and secondary schools, and now we're also going to be working with universities as well. So basically that 5 to 25-year-old age group as such are the ones that are the actual movers and shakers, and the ones that are really, I mean, you know yourself, it's incredible, the amount of enthusiasm and passion and action items that children can change their family, their community groups, if they're at the soccer club or whatever, they've got their own network. And we've actually worked out that each child has a network of 450 people. So when you go through their school life, they know 450 people. And then those 450 people have the potential to reach another 450 people each. So the network is enormous. So by harnessing the enthusiasm, the passion, and the can-do attitude that kids so readily do, we can make that change from the bottom up and the top down. So our philosophy is very much, this is not something that's segmented. Everybody in the world needs to be doing something, but the kids and that cohort are the massive drivers that can make it happen much faster. And that's what we need. We need speed to slow down the greenhouse gas global warming issue, which is scary.
Imagine if every kid that was in a school where EPIC program was involved went and told their 450 network friends and all the rest of it about the program and the message of EPIC and POA. That's just what a huge thing that would be, right?
Yeah. Well, we can do it. We can do it. And so what we do is we work in our own circular economy. So what we've found that's been working super well is we work with the businesses, government, and the school communities or any community group. And very often we find that we can get support from government entities to fund the school's program, or we get businesses that want to work with the schools or just be really good corporate social responsible citizens, and they fund the school's program because they know how important it is. And we rely heavily, obviously, on funding because we are an NGO. And sometimes the schools can't afford to take up the program. So we find that by working with a government, so maybe we've got, you know, councils will fund it, the schools are doing it, the councils are doing it at the same time. They are working together to show the results of what they've done. So while the council's running, we're running the EPIC program in council, the kids are doing the same thing that they're doing in the schools. And there's that wonderful synergy, which people like to see what the residents are doing is the same as what staff of the council that are telling them what to do are doing. So they're all walking the same walk and it's not separate, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, well, you should do that, but we're just going to sit here in our glass tower and do what we do, but you have to do the work and we're just going to sit here and keep doing what we do. So we found that this, our little POA circular economy through our programs, is a really wonderful way to grow that network, to speed things up. The whole thing is about speeding things up and then go right up to the manufacturers, to state government, federal government, and we really, that policy change. And, you know, thankfully we've got a wonderful environment minister at the moment who's doing a lot in the plastic pollution space. Tanya Plibersek's been amazing. She's really, you know, true to her word in some things, not everything, but no politician's perfect. But some of them are better than others. And I think she's really trying really hard to make some really, you know, really dramatic changes, which is really admirable, particularly like the International Plastic Treaty, which POA's involved in as well. And we put forward papers and we're on the groups that, you know, there's a group of NGOs that are part of that voice. So we're trying up and down the whole, any way that we can communicate, whether it be through government and policy, or whether just talking to kids at school or running a public campaign like Picnics Unwrapped, there's no stone that we can leave unturned.
No, that's great, Ricky. And for anybody that is interested in learning more about the EPIC program or how to get involved, the website will be in the show notes, or you could just look up Plastic Oceans Australasia online and you can read a little bit more about it there. Ricky, I want to take us back out, or zoom us back out a little bit to where we, almost where we started this conversation. And we're talking about behavior change at what might be a really local level here with EPIC, and the actions that we can all take in our home or in our workplace or in our community. Do you think as a global community, we're doing enough, we're being proactive enough to reach the goals that these policies, legislative instruments, and other items on the global scale are trying to achieve? Or are we still lagging in many ways?
Oh, just look at your book, Paul. Like, you know, your book is a great example of an easy way for people to make big steps forward. Plastology, your Plastology project book. However, the support from government is not enough. What we need is the mandates that have been coming in the different states, for example, just in Australia, are inconsistent. The mandates are not, the timeline for the mandates or specific single-use plastic items are not the same. So you've got one state that might be doing a handful of products that's different to another state. The timeline of when those mandates come in is, as I said, is different. And then you've got some states that aren't doing it still for a few years, like in Northern Territory. You know, they've got way different timelines. So some of them, they haven't even started very much of any of those products. And the thing that concerns me is the handful of products that have been highlighted, and there is a very it's well documented, and there's a chart that we show everybody which shows the ticks of all the different items that have been phased that are mandated out, like straws, for example, and plastic bags and water bottles, et cetera, et cetera. It's just the tip of the iceberg. There's thousands of single-use plastic high-volume products that should be stopped already now, stopped and mandated out, not in 5 years, not in 2 years, not in 10 years. It should be across the board, a blanket approach of just that's it. You have 3 months, that's it. Not 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, now, that's it. Just phase it out in 3 months. And if it means that you just, you might have a cupboard full of plastic cutlery, what do you do with it? Well, you can actually take the virgin plastic material, as in it's not been used yet, and it can actually go and could be recycled to make like furniture, park benches. So it never ends up in the landfill space, because the park furniture, for example, companies like Replaz and various other ones that are making, you know, solid, hard items, it takes it out of that whole supply chain, and it's not going to be ever back in the system. Or if it is, hopefully by then we've really knocked this on its head, because that would be 40, 50, 60 years later. You know, we work with companies like Compan that are making playground equipment, for example, and they've got a green sustainability stream, and they're doing the same with looking at what they can do to reduce the energy and the LCA. They look at the modelling of what goes into the product. So there is a lot more that needs to be done. So how do we do that? The change has to come from a lot more voices coming from the bottom, as in not the bottom, but us, the community, everybody, the individuals talking and going and standing at the steps, waving the flags and saying, this is not okay, we're not going to do it. And also I always say to everybody, whenever you go to the supermarket, if you want to buy a product and the product is wrapped in plastic, like packs of bananas, and packs of apples, and packs of cucumbers. I mean, the list is massive in the fresh fruit section, the fresh produce section. If people just would say, no, we're not going to buy it, we are just not buying it, it wouldn't take long for the supermarkets, to go back to the farmers, to go back up the line, and or not, well, actually in between the supermarket, you've got the company that produces the packaging, which is then what the farmers' products go into, etc., that whole supply chain. It wouldn't actually take that long if enough people would say, no, I'm not going to buy it. So that would be the one action you asked me, sorry, long-winded. One action would be, don't buy anything in the supermarket that you know doesn't need to be wrapped in plastic, like a banana.
Hear, hear. I absolutely agree. Nothing infuriates me further than when I walk into the supermarket and it's just a sea of plastic wrapped produce. And my first response to that is, well, why is there so much plastic? My second response is, well, how fresh is this produce if it is wrapped in plastic? It's a long time since it's been in the ground or on a tree, if it's then passed through a facility that allows it to be wrapped in a plastic film and then on the shelf. It always concerns me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's just one very little thing you've mentioned. What could people do, and it's not fast enough. So I think the government needs to get to, one of the things that we've been driving is asking the federal government to look at unifying the timelines with all the states and have a much deeper dive into expanding the product listing much, much more, far greater products like the soy sauce bottle, which, you know, this little fish soy sauce bottle. You know, and these little sachets that people use, you know, for salad cream and all that, which we've mentioned before. But there's just a zillion things that could be done, and that could be then spread out right across the globe. It doesn't have to be; it could be any country. And we all know, for example, you know, when I go to Indonesia or the Philippines, they live on plastic. Everything is multi-wrapped in plastic 5 million times. It makes no sense to me at all. I just don't get it. I don't know what you think about that, Paul.
Yes, I agree. Everything is plastic on plastic on plastic. And you just think, why is this the case? And, well, you could theorize why that is the case. I suspect it has a lot to do with the market.
It's convenient.
Convenient, yeah, absolutely. And it's the same as well in Africa. A lot of items are single sachets, you know, sugar or coffee. It's all these single plastic sachets. And last season, spoke to Taryn Johnson in the Hennops River in South Africa. And one of the major waste items seen in that river is these single-use plastic sachets. And that's a huge plastic burden that we see all over the world, and that's something as well, in my opinion, that needs to be gotten rid of.
How do we do that, Paul?
How do we do that? Well, the first of all, as you know, is about educating. People need to be aware of the problem, but also the solutions, and that's why the EPIC program for me is a really valuable resource for schools, individuals, and businesses, and particularly the access to the Swap app, because it allows people to make informed purchasing decisions, not only in their business or in their school, but also in their personal life as consumers in retail stores and so on. It allows people to know what alternatives are out there and how to make different choices to help reduce plastic pollution.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, it's a challenge, but that's why I love what we're doing through the TAP team, which is so, so incredibly important. So our work is underpinned through science and research. And one of the projects, as you know, that we are working on is the microplastic fish project, looking at two commercially eaten fish in Sydney Harbour, your stomping ground, to see the results of that. Because the other thing that a lot of people still don't connect with is that the plastic breaks up and becomes microplastic, microfiber, nano noodles, etc. And we're actually breathing it in. We're eating it, we're breathing it, and we really need to document this much faster. The health industry is already showing about the carcinogenics through plastic and ingestion. There is talk of the equivalent that we are consuming up to the equivalent of a credit card of plastic each individual a year. I'm not quite sure about the data on that, but that's been talked about a lot over the last couple of years, I think, as a scare factor. But it definitely is true that we are breathing in the microplastic molecules. We don't know. We can't see it because it's not, you know, big enough for the naked eye. But that's scary. That is super, super scary. And it's in animals. It's in, you know, the bloodstream of unborn babies with the placenta, all that sort of thing. So those sort of things are very, very scary. And if that doesn't hit home to people, I don't know what else will.
Yes, and there's research just this month, actually, that indicates that plastic is entering into the human brain shortly after ingestion. Now, of course, there needs to be further work done on that to validate the data and the findings. But certainly at this point in time, that is also quite concerning. It's not good.
No, but that's why we have to be positive and help turn it around. And the only way we're going to make change is by knowing that what we're doing does make a difference. But it's got to be faster. It's got to be all different areas, all the different segments of our economy and of the business world as well as the community world.
Absolutely. And actually, Ricky, that brings us to June of this year, 2023. We have two very exciting dates, World Environment Day and World Oceans Day. And for POA and many of us, these two dates this year are quite significant. Could you explain to the audience why they're significant, why everybody's getting excited about it, and what POA is doing to mark these two occasions?
Oh, thanks, Paul. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I talked about that yet. So every year for us, obviously with our title being Plastic Oceans Australasia, we obviously really always want to focus the world and everybody that's connected with us on World Ocean Day. This year, and World Ocean Day always falls on June 8th, and this year, World Ocean Day and World Environment Day, which always falls on June 5th, so they're both always in the same week, which is a bit of a conundrum if there's completely diametrically opposed topics. But this year, yay, the stars or the oceans have aligned or the waters have aligned or the lands have aligned. And they have got the theme of World Environment Day is Beat Plastic Pollution, and World Ocean Day, the theme is about tide, plastic, planet, ocean, tides are changing. So the two things for us are just absolutely phenomenally wonderful. We are doing a pre-recorded conversation, of which I'm excited that you're going to be there with us with your science hat on and your author hat and all the other amazing things that you do. We've got a terrific cinematographer, Dan Abbott, who is well-renowned with the work that he does with photography under, above the water and below the water, all over the world, which is really terrific to have his view. And what he sees and what he's found and what he's been working on. And then we've also got a wonderful youth ambassador, which is Nicola Sitsis, who's also on our one of our volunteers with our Picnic Sun Ratch campaign. But she's also with the World Ocean Day forum group. So that's really fantastic. So we've got people from all walks of life talking about it. And we are giving that out for anybody, anywhere, whether it's a school, whether it's a business, whether it's government. We're providing the recording of this conversation, hearty, healthy, hard-hitting conversation about no blue, no green. So the title of that conversation is No Blue, No Green. Very, 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 very clear on that. So basically from the beginning of June all the way through to the end of June, anybody, anywhere, can I get the link for that recording. We'll have it up ready on the website for people. They just have to send us a link if they're interested. It'll be on our pop-up as well on our page in a couple of weeks, so people can just subscribe and get that, and they'll get that. And it's all free. We just want people to do things and make a difference.
And of course, Ricky, that leads into one of the other initiatives, Ocean in Motion.
Yeah, exactly. So the reason we've got the cinematographer Dan Abbott on is we're going to be obviously giving people an action that they can take away from that conversation, which is entering our film competition. So every year, this is our fourth year now, we run a film competition, which in the past was primarily for schools and school students, but we've had such great interest. We are now opening up to the community. So we've got four categories, great prizes. There's a standalone separate website that we have called oceaninmotion.org.au. If people want to go to that website, they can actually sign up and also throw their hat in the ring to enter the competition. That is open right through to the end of October. So if people want to make a 5-minute movie on what they're trying to do to make a change in their plastic journey, whether it be on a school campus or at their home or with their community group or in their business, it doesn't matter, wherever they are, they're welcome to enter that. Again, it's not about it could be what you have done. It could be what you haven't done and want to do. It could be the challenges of why you couldn't do it. Like during COVID, a few people did a movie for us about why they couldn't do what they had planned to do because of COVID. So that in itself was an entry. So we're really, really open to people just putting their heads together and their hands and wanting to show how they want to make a difference. So it can be something you have done, something you want to do, or something for the future that can be. So it's very, very, very diverse. But that is a way to give people something to do, to focus on and activate them by making a little film. And everyone has a hand phone of some sort, and you can just do the movie on your smartphone or your Android or whatever. You don't have to be a great, you don't have to be the Dan Abbott's, but he's going to give some tips and tricks and talk about how he got into it and why what you see can impact us and make a change so much faster than just reading something. So what is it? Over 80% of people in the world are visually impacted, and then it's audio, you go through our five senses. That's working down the line. So we will talk about that actually with the conversation. So thank you for reminding me about that. And I just also will say OIM is sponsored by our very dear partners, Separtus, who have been supporting us for the campaign the last few years. So we're very grateful for them, and they're doing some great scientific research work as well.
I love it. I look forward to catching some of the short films that get produced and, hearing about the great work that the community is doing. It's going to be good.
Absolutely, for sure.
Ricky, it's been great having a chat with you today and learning more about Plastic Oceans Australasia, even from somebody who is within on the TAP team. I'm not across all of the different components of what goes on. So it's been great learning about some of the other areas that I'm not involved with. Is there anything else that you wanted to share with the audience that we haven't yet spoken about?
First of all, thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate it. I guess the only other one would be in September, we have our Picnic Sunwrap campaign, which is a great way to get people together and enjoy what people love doing, which is eating, drinking and hanging out, which we've missed for a few years. And that also is a way to drive change, particularly about food packaging and soft plastic waste. So again, those two things go together hand in hand. So if people are interested and they don't want to do a film and they're not into that, they can certainly enter and have a picnic and also, win some great prizes and just, again, keep people activated and on point with what we're trying to do. So thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it, and talk to you soon, no doubt.
That's been great, Ricky. Thank you for joining us. This has been another episode of the Plasticology Project podcast. Thanks for listening.